Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the 6th of Shvat. And today we're going to be discussing a responsible by Rav Herzog from the 6th of Shvat of... It's undated. He's responding to a letter that was the 6th of Shvat, but it was a tshuva, a responsible that was too tempting for me to leave by because it's Rav Herzog writing about whether we can trust chemical analysis for halachic purposes. And that's interesting to me because Rav Herzog is well known for having been a chemist, for having written a PhD in chemistry, and I believe his PhD was where he tried to discover what techelet was chemically. What was the chemical, what was the animal that would be considered techelet? And he made a whole bunch of discussions in what is in some circles now thought of as being the snail that produces tchela, the Murex trunculus, was an idea that he had and then discarded for various reasons. But the whole idea of chemistry being relevant to halacha was certainly something that was on his mind, and he was asked about it. This is in Heichal Yitzchak Orach Chaim, Siman Nun Aleph, the 51st response from the Orach Chaim section of his book of response, Heichal Yitzchak. And the question is actually about a chametz. It's a chametz question. And here's the story. There's some people in Israel who have juices that they import from Italy. And these juices are made from wine and flowers of some sort. And they say that they're not careful. They themselves admit they're not careful about whether there might be non-kosher wine in them, but they think it's all mixed in, and therefore it doesn't count, and therefore they think it should be okay. However that works, right? That's an underlying factor, is that these people who are importing this are not that concerned about halakha, and they're not concerned about the kashas of these things, and they're maybe trying to circumvent the religious authorities of the time. And they didn't ask anybody. And now the question is, what about for Pesach? Because in Pesach terms, if they don't get a hechsher from the Rabbanut, they can't sell it on Pesach. So that seems to have been the law, that they could stop them from selling it on Pesach, although the rest of the year they couldn't. So since we can't trust them, we can't trust them about what they say, because they're the people who are taking in juices that have a mixture of non-kosher wine, they don't care about it, so they become people that we can't trust about what the ingredients are in this mixture. So the question is, could it be that we could do a chemical analysis of these juices, whatever they are, these liquids, and find out whether or not there's any chametz, there's any leaven in them. Herzog points out that it's not just these owners of this business that we don't trust. We, in general, don't trust business owners unless we have a strong understanding that they are Yirei Shemayim, they are observant Jews who care a lot about halacha. But in general, just ordinary people, even ordinary Jews, we wouldn't do. So then he points out that even in the time of Chazal, you have evidence that you can't trust people who have a stake in something. So for example, Chazal say that Kohanim were suspected of, if you found a coin with a bechor that had a mum on it, we suspect Kohanim of putting mumim in bechorim, so they wouldn't have to offer it as a sacrifice, and they could just keep it for themselves. You had all this, you had these problems with they could give it back to the owners and make money off it. But whatever it shows that even people who you would think of as being observant and caring about halacha, we can't necessarily trust them. So it all depends, he says, on the condition of that generation, and it depends on the time and the place. There are certain times and places where you trust people much more because the general people are, in fact, more careful about halacha, and there's times they're not. So the time of Chazal points out where most Amei Haaretz, most ordinary people, meaning uneducated people who didn't have a particular attachment to halacha, would nonetheless tithe their agricultural produce, right? From agricultural produce, you're supposed to take truma, and then you're supposed to take maaser. So maaser is a tithe, and there was some people who didn't bother to take it. Truma, almost everybody took, apparently, because it's a mitah b'dei shamayim. The punishment for eating produce that has not had truma properly taken from it is that Hashem, or heaven, will find a way to give that person the death penalty they deserve. So that people tended to take. But when it came to maaseh, which is, if not taken, not given to a levi, is a financial wrong, so there people were somewhat more lax about it. And so there was a significant enough minority who didn't take maaseh that Chazal created this thing called demai. So demai was that you had to, that if you are a halakhically observant person and you buy produce from somebody whose observance you're not sure about, you don't know if you can trust, you're supposed to take maaseh again from it, and that's called demai. So you see that Chazal tended to be suspicious of people, or tended to be realistic is probably a better word. Realistic about people, and if you know that people either do or are tempted to not tell the truth about kashrus issues or about the status of certain foods or certain products, so then you can't trust them about it. So and then Rav Herzog says, the kal v'chomer liyameinu shenit ma'ata yirat chet, and a little more so in our times when there's really much less yirat chet, fear of sin, than there was once upon a time. That's obviously especially true of these people who have these juices that might have some non-kosher wine in them, and they didn't care enough to verify that fact, to find out what the truth was about it. And Rav Herzog says, in this situation, hakol lefi ra'ot einei hadayan v'chacham einav v'rosho, everybody's really up to the person on the ground, the person who sort of knows the situation, is the one who gets to judge it. That's a comment that he's throwing away, that he's tossing off as obvious in the context of this particular case, but it's got very broad ramifications, because I think there are many people who would like to say that halacha has to be this kind of thing where it applies in a mechanical way. And if I look up the halacha, I should know how to, I do know, people will think, if I look up halacha and I look up the books, then I'm going to know how to apply it to every situation. And Rav Herzog is pointing out that here is at least one situation, and there are many others, where that's just simply not true, where even if you know all the halachic issues, you then have to make a judgment call. And that judgment call is in the hands of a Torah scholar, and not just any Torah scholar, but a Torah scholar who is on the ground in the moment, who knows the people involved and can make the proper judgment. So you might say, Rav Herzog says, you might say that, no, we should say that we can trust them because it's a milta d'avida l'igluye. Milta d'avida l'igluye means that people don't tend to lie about things where they know the lie will eventually be revealed, because there's no value in it. That this is Rav Herzog's topic, but it's striking because we assume that in halacha in many, many cases. But it's funny because we know of cases, we all know of cases where that's not true, where people tell these lies and they have to know it's going to come out, they just don't think about it. So an example that comes to my mind always is when you have Ponzi schemes, right? You have these schemes where people are taking money from one source and giving to another source and skimming off for themselves, and there's no way they're ever going to be able to fully catch up with it. They're eventually going to blow up in their face and they're going to get caught, and it happens over and over again. You think to yourself, how could they do that when they know they're going to get caught? So halachically, a milta d'avida l'igluye is supposed to be the kind of thing people wouldn't bother lying about because they know they're going to get caught. But Rav Herzog says here, it's not really avida l'igluye. The full composition, the exactly what went into these juices is not the kind of thing that people are going to find out, because people who have industries like that in the beverage industry, in the food industry, people are very careful that other people don't come into their production facilities because they don't want to know. It'd be like, you know, the secret formula to Coke, right? So they don't want people to know the secret formula to Coke, so it's a very heavily guarded industry secret. So Rav Herzog says that's true. So I got interrupted, but I think I'm talking about the secret to Coke, that people who produce foods and drinks don't want people to know their secrets, and therefore they guard it carefully. So therefore, it's not a milta d'avida l'igluye, because they're going to do everything they can to make sure that people don't know exactly what goes into these juices, because otherwise people will just make them on their own and not buy them for them. So you say, well, but we can analyze it chemically. We can do a chemical analysis. We can figure out all the ingredients. So Rav Herzog says, and this is another kind of a statement where you're going to have to judge it in every time and place. He says, who knows if chemical analysis, in fact, can plumb the depths of the item, as it were, meaning if you can get to all the ingredients. So today you might say you get to more, but the question of whether a chemical analysis can really single out or identify every single item within it, he's not sure about that, at least back then. So Herzog lives, you know, the end of his life was the late 40s and early 50s. So that, you know, it could be that there have been advances in chemical analysis since then, and that you'd have to revisit this question. But that was something that he wanted to raise. If people say it's got to be milta d'avida l'igluye, it's something that is eventually going to be known, so therefore we can trust them because they know they're going to get caught if they lie about it, because people will figure it out. So he says, well, but they're going to guard the secret, and if they're guarding the secret, then maybe people won't find it out. So he'll say, well, but even if they're going to try to guard the secret, we can do a chemical analysis on it. And he says, well, but chemical analysis doesn't necessarily go as far as we'd like it to. So that would become another question. If it became, and the truth is, I think there would be two questions here. Not only is chemical analysis, Rav Herzog passed away, I just looked it up, in 1959. So this could be in the course of the 50s, and the level of chemical analysis is there. So the coming back to the tshuva, the question would be, not only does chemical analysis work, but do the owners of this refinery or this factory or this production facility know how well it works and know it well enough that it will therefore in their minds be a milta David Likluya such that they would not lie about it, right? Because if the question is, can we trust the owners such that when they say there's no chametz in it, we can just trust them, you need to know not that we could analyze it, because we're not planning actually to analyze it. We could theoretically analyze it, but that's not what the plan is. The plan is to trust what they say about it by virtue of the fact that they say that it doesn't have anything in it. We're going to say, well, it's a milta d'avida ligluya, and therefore it's got to be that we can trust them about it. And he says, and that's particularly complicated in terms of Pesach, because ordinarily in mixtures, the amount of a mixture that has to go in has to be that it gives ta'am, that it gives taste. But when it comes to Pesach, we rule that even a dover ha-ma'amid is a problem. So a dover ha-ma'amid is something that contributes meaningfully to the composition of an item, even if it leaves no taste whatsoever. So in a dover ha-ma'amid, at least on Pesach, afilu be'elef lo batil, even if it's one part in a thousand, we think that it's a problem, because a dover ha-ma'amid contributes to the composition of the item, and therefore we can't allow for that. And then the question would be, will a chemical analysis get even things in those small amounts, and those trace amounts, will the chemical analysis catch it? Because halakhically, it's a problem, and we can't necessarily catch that in that situation. And therefore, he says, you can't say that just because people say that there's no tarovin in there, and the rumor is, and all the word we know about it is there's no mixture of chametz in there, it's not necessarily that we can rely on such information. A piece of counter information, now we come to part of the reason why the tshuva struck me so much is that Rafotzik now brings up the topic, although he doesn't mention his PhD dissertation or any of that issues, but he brings up the question of tchelet. So tchelet is the bluish string that was supposed to be, or strings that were supposed to be on tzitziot. So for a long time, Jews didn't know what that string was, and then in the 1800s, there were always people who tried to figure it out. In the 1800s, the Radziner Rebbe decided that he had figured out what that blue was, and so there are people who wear what's called Radziner Tchelet. And then in the late 20th century, and into our times, there's other people, more in the Tilumi camp, I would say, more like religious Zionist, the names escape me, Baruch Sturman, I think, and Ari Greenspan. Right, are the ones who discovered, who think that they've discovered or claim they've discovered, and if there's good solid evidence they have. I remember when I was a student at YU, Rabbi Lamb and Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Tendler, all of whom got together to say that they all were convinced by these arguments, and they were all wearing tchelet in their talitot. So that tchelet, that discovery of tchelet, is a modern phenomenon. But tchelet is this bluish string. Already in the time of the Gemara, speaks about the question of how we know what is tekel and what isn't tekel, because the Gemara knew of something called kala ilan. Kala ilan was a much cheaper dye, much more less expensive dye that looked bluish as well, and it wasn't easy to tell the difference between them. So he points out there's a Gemara in Menachot Membet and Memgimel, which he doesn't like quote at length, and we don't have to get into the specifics of it, but the Gemara has a story there, has a report there that Rabbi Yitzchak, the son of Rabbi Yehuda, found a way to check whether or not something had been dyed with tchelet or had been dyed with kala ilan, with this non-tchelet dye that was much less expensive and invalid and a worry for Chazal, because they were worried that there would be people who would put kala ilan on, so the kala ilan on their tzitzit, so they would look like they had used tchelet, and nobody would be upset with them for not using tchelet, but they wouldn't pay the money for it. So that form of checking, where Herzog says, if you look carefully at it, it's a form of chemical analysis, whatever it is. So that would suggest, if they did in the time of the Gemara, we should be able to do a chemical analysis as well and rely on chemical analysis. So if Herzog says, well, there's a couple of doubts I have about that. First of all, don't know that just because that form of chemical analysis works, that this one does, because that could be an easier form of chemical error. It could be an easier check, meaning the difference between kala ilan and tchelet could be so easily identified with, you know, whatever it is, that could be an infinite meaning. For example, if I said to you, you're allowed to use litmus paper to check whether something is acidic or basic, that doesn't set up a general principle that you can use chemical analysis in halacha. Right? Let's say, I don't know of any halacha that depends on whether something is acidic or basic. Let's say there was a halacha that was concerned with whether a mixture is more acidic or basic, and we said halacha, the Gemara said, clearly, you can use litmus paper to check out that fact. So that's sort of what Herzog is saying about the tekeilah check. It's a relatively simple check. But the fact that you can use a relatively simple check in halakha doesn't necessarily mean you can use the more complicated one that would be trying to check out whether there is any traces of chametz, whether there's any chametz in this juice that these people have imported. Secondly, he says, and this is a broader halakhic question, if they allowed checking it in terms of tchelet, well, you know what? Tchelet is a mitzvah aseh. It's a positive commandment. It's an obligation in the Torah to where it sits with tchelet. That's fine. That's an important thing. But the fact that we'll rely on a certain level of certainty of information value in terms of trusting that something is tchelet, because in a case of mitzvah aseh, does not necessarily mean that we're allowed to rely on it for chametz, because chametz, after all, is a karet issue. It's an issue where if somebody willfully eats chametz, if they eat chametz deliberately and on purpose, they would get karet for it. So there, the standards are, in general, much higher. Now, notice that Rav Herzog is saying, and I'm not questioning this at all, I think he's absolutely right, it's just really worth noticing. He's saying that because the topic is a chametz topic, so in this case, it still would have been true that anybody who's eating it doesn't know that they're eating it, so they're not eating it on purpose, they're eating it b'shogeg, and therefore it would never be a karet issue. So his point isn't that we're worried that people actually get karet, it's that the standards of evidence, and the standards of proof, and the standards of information when it comes to issues that have a karet in them are higher. So then he says, you know, you may know that in the Gemara, Rava thinks that when it comes to a biblical, what he says is, kol b'doraita, if we're talking about a biblical issue, it doesn't matter if it's an ordinary prohibition or if it's a karet, you rely on the same standards of information. So Rav Herzog says, that's in terms of prohibitions. Rava's claim is that prohibitions are all so serious that whatever the information is that we can rely on for malkut prohibitions, for ordinary prohibitions, that we get lashes if they were transgressed deliberately and on purpose, we would also use for karet. But that doesn't necessarily have to mean that we do it in terms of that doesn't necessarily mean that which we would do in terms of positive commandments, we can also do in terms of prohibitions like karet prohibitions. So, and Rav Herzog says, and I can show you that Rava thinks that way about it, because Rava, as happens in Menachot, also compares an Isser Karet of Chametz to an Aseh Be'alma. And he says if we can rely on written testimony about an issue that has to do with a Karet, we can certainly rely on it, and that's to with an Aseh, with an ordinary obligation in the Torah. Now, when you say certainly, that means you're saying that it's more significant, not that they're the same level. So once you say that Karet is clearly more significant of an issue and has more concern about the kind of information we'll rely on than an assay, than an ordinary obligation, then if we rely on something in terms of an obligation, it doesn't necessarily mean we can rely on it in terms of a kari prohibition. So the fact that we can rely on chemical analysis of the sort that will tell us the difference between kola ilon and techelet, that will tell us the difference between these two kinds of blue dyes, that doesn't necessarily apply to our kari situation of chametz on Pesach. Then he says, but there could be certain leniencies here that would get us out of that problem. So, for example, if the lees that were used in this juice, that were mixed into this juice, had, before they got mixed in, been gotten to the level where a dog wouldn't beat them, puzzle, they were psule me'akilat kelev is the standard. So then you can use them in something, but they're not being used as food anymore. They don't count as food. Once a dog wouldn't eat them anymore, halakhically they don't count as food. So there are those, or for some purposes, he says, there are those who hold that there's no chi of karet if you eat such foods, right? Even if you eat it on purpose, because it's not no longer really food. So that's a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ravid. And then he says also, by the way, since this is all mixed in to a juice, so it was already mixed in with another liquid, and when you have a mixture of liquids, that's called a tarovet chametz, it's called a mixture of chametz, and mixtures of chametz are also not karet issues. The two, and more so, he says, when you put the meats into, you put this juice, let's say, into a vodka, I think that's what eventually happened, to kind of a spirit, not a vodka, because that would be chametz on its own, but a spirit of some sort, an alcoholic beverage of some sort. He says, certainly, there's more than 60 in the beverage than of whatever it was that might possibly have chametz on it. And then it's true, he said, a davar amami, something that contributes to the constitution and to the importance, to making up an item, is not batel, but that halacha is derabanan. So he says, Rav Herzog, so then maybe you could argue that we can use chemical analysis because it's not a karet issue anymore. It's not a karet issue anymore in the fact that it's pasul me'achilat kelev, it's no longer able to be eaten by a dog, and therefore it's not food in that sense. It's already mixed into a mixture, and in that mixture, so mixture already, the fact of a mixture makes it Torah, which is a different halachic category than regular karet, and then in that mixture, it's not even a notin tam, it's only a davar hamamid, which is, it's only a problem because it's a davar hamamid, because there's not enough of it to be a problem in terms of, in other terms, and therefore all of that makes it not really a karet, and therefore whatever standard, whatever level of chemical analysis you would have used for tchelet, maybe we could say we could use that here. But he says, after all that, he still holds that, I don't know for sure, because the clay, the check that Chazal used with chelet is much, much more simple and more straightforward, and therefore it's more certain that it's going to get to the truth of it, and therefore I'm not sure that we can rely on this. I want to just pause and say that he jumps here from saying that it's an Isser Kares, even though let's say it was an Isser Kares, an absolute Isser Kares, anybody who would be drinking from it would be doing it b'shogeg, there he thinks the standard of Kares still applies. It still applies. This is considered an item that's an item of Kares, and therefore the question of whether you can use the standards of proof or evidence or information that you would have used by an ordinary prohibition, whether or not you're allowed to apply those to Kares issues comes into play. But then, when he says, but the items we're using could never themselves be chayef and kares, that he thinks it changes the picture. I could have easily imagined arguing that once we're in the area of kares, maybe those standards should apply, but Rav Herzog does not say that. Rav Herzog is clear that what he means is, when you think of it as a kares item, if and only if the item as it is now, were it to be eaten or ingested in a deliberate fashion, would incur a karet liability. But once it's an item that could never incur a karet liability, then it's not a karet issue anymore. But he's still not sure of it because of the question of whether or not the fact that the Gemara used a relatively simple check, like a litmus paper check basically, whether or not that has any relevance to the kind of chemical analysis you have to do to find out whether there's chametz in this juice, it's not dregs, and these lees, and these concentrated pieces of whatever it is they imported from Italy. Points out that the truth is that we have proof from the Gemara that we use such checks, although it's again, I think, a Kala Ilan check, but the Kala Ilan check that we've been talking about, but we use it even in the case of Lavin. So that would help us because we said that the opinion of Rava was, if we use it for Torah prohibitions, we can use it for Karet as well. And the reason why he says we can use it for Lavin is the Gemara talks about checking the tzitzis and whether or not it's tchelet or not, and the worry is about kilayim issues, because the halacha is that in the Torah you're not allowed to wear kilayim. Kilayim in clothing context, when you mix tzemer u'pishtim yachdav, when you mix wool and linen in the same item, but you're allowed to do it if it's for tzitzis, meaning you're allowed to have linen tzitzis on a wool garment or wool tzitzis on a linen garment. So tcheles is always in wool. Tcheles strings always have to be in wool. There are no tcheles strings in tzitzis. Tcheles is a blue dyed wool. So if you put that on a linen garment, that would be theoretically kilayim, but it's allowed. But if somebody's wearing Kala Ilan, so then it's not allowed anymore, because Kala Ilan is not a valid form of tchelis, and therefore they're not fulfilling a mitzvah by putting it in, so it's kilayim, it's a problem. So the Gemara says, you do this check, it'll allow you to check whether you have strings, you don't know what they are. You do this check, now you can wear it on any garment you want to, including a linen garment. So that means, Rav Herzog is pointing out, that this check is being used in terms of a lo ta'aseh kilayim, which is, by the way, considered in many contexts an important and a serious prohibition. All prohibitions are serious, but even more so, there's a mission in kilayim, in the ninth parak of kilayim, that says, refers to quotes for us, mishin lovesh kilayim nalos umeliz alaviv shevashamayim. Somebody who wears kilayim is sort of casting aspersions on Hashem. So apparently it means that since we trust this check for an assay, for an obligation, so that makes it a right to establishment of a fact. And since it's establishing the fact that this is not Kala Ilan, we're allowed to rely on it in terms of putting it into tzitzis that would otherwise be Kilayim as well. Then he gets to a whole question that I'm going to skip a little bit about whether chazaka and how chazakos work and whether we can try which chazakot we can rely on and what we know, what we don't know, and what standards we have. We're going to skip that and we're going to leave that for another time. I will just say that there are cases where, many cases that he points out, where we have to figure out whether we rely on the existing status of something, or we think that status might have changed. So You have it with women, a woman whose husband goes with her co-wife to Medina, and they go off on a trip, and then it turns out he's dead, but the co-wife hasn't showed up again. So the Gemara says she can't get married, and she can't have Yibum, because maybe her co-wife became pregnant. So that means that even though she wasn't pregnant when she left, that's a status that we assume is liable or prone to change. But we say, let's say there was no co-wife, but there was a mother-in-law who was still of childbearing age, which is kind of an interesting thing, right? Let's say these are a teen bride, which happened a lot in the time of the Gemara. You had a teen bride, so the mother could be 32, 33, so she easily could have children, but she's in a faraway place, and the husband dies. Does she have to find out for sure from her mother-in-law that the mother-in-law isn't pregnant with somebody who could theoretically do Yibum to her? The answer is no, that you don't. So Rav Nachman says there that the first case was an Isser Karet, so they don't rely on the Chazaka. They worry that maybe the co-wife has become pregnant, because to marry a brother-in-law, right, if she knows that her husband died and he didn't have any children, to marry a brother-in-law, and there is a brother-in-law, to marry a brother-in-law is a Karet prohibition. So in a Karet prohibition, we don't rely on Chazakot, but if there's no for sure brother-in-law out there, and we know the husband died, and the only question is whether or not there might be a brother-in-law out there, that's not a karet anymore. That's an iser lav or an iser asay, that she's not allowed to get married again until she has yibum or chalitza, and there we can rely on chazaka. So those kinds of examples, he gives a few more and goes into discussion then, but those kinds of examples are part of the discussion here of what rely on in terms of what standards, what when we assume that the reality we always thought of till now has continued, and when we think that it changes in these contexts. So, in conclusion of this tshuva, he says, we generally find that Chazal do rely on checking nature in the way that that we know about nature being checked, even in terms of current issues. So, for example, he says, you look all from a Masechet Nida, the question of whether or not a woman who has, let's say, had a miscarriage, and what she's miscarried, how that affects whether or not she's Tmeah or Tahora, and how that affects whether she's ritually pure or not, whether she and her husband can resume marital relations, and when they can resume marital relations, all of which are karet issues, because if a husband and wife have relations when she is halakhically either a nida or a zava, so that's a karet prohibition. So the Gemara is clearly, and the Gemara there uses natural ways of figuring out the nature of the miscarriage, of how far along it was, and what kinds of halakhic ramifications that has. So, first, like I said, you see that they rely on natural checks of things. In terms of kilayim as well, they check the, sometimes they check the color of things, and in terms of, or they'll put various dyes on it to see whether clothing was of mixed threads or not. And in Gittin, you have it in terms of shichvat zera, if you want to know if something is semen or not, or if it produces ritual impurity or not of certain things. So that you do by certain natural checks that they knew of. You do it with treifot in the Gemara, at least. You have lots and lots of times where it seems like they just follow the natural order and natural laws. They know them, and if there is some natural order that tells them a reality, they rely on it. But there are times when poskim in our times and earlier times also will say, we no longer know those bedikot so well. This is what the Refertzak says. We can't use these checks because our senses have dulled. That's what he says. Either our senses have dulled or the checks have dulled. So I would just point out that I happened to look up this piece in the Shulchan Aruch that he's referring to, and it says there that we no longer rely on, let's say, if you want to check a ketem, a stain in a garment, for whether or not it was blood or not, there are seven cleansing agents that the Gemara lists. And so Rav Herzog seems to be saying that we don't rely on those checks because our ability to see whether the dye was removed it or not has gone away, or these things don't work as well as they once did. But when you look at Shulchan Aruch just says, we're not sure that we know what they are. We're not sure we know these names correspond to things that we think that they do. And also, the Rama says that there are times when there's something that looks like a treifa, but could have happened in a way that we don't know about, that it happened in a way that makes it not a treifa, and then we don't know these things. So it seems in the Shulchan Aruch Rama, as far as I can tell, they didn't mean that our senses are dull, they meant that we don't know these checks so well anymore. The reason why that's important is what Rav Herzog is going to say. So those things might not work anymore. We don't know if they work anymore. And Shulchan Aruch and Rama would have said it slightly differently. We don't know what they are anymore. But in terms of chemical analysis, so that today, we use it a lot. And it works very, very well. And it's almost like it's absolutely true. And so we don't have to, so it would seem like you should be able to do it. And he says, and don't tell me that there's an halakha, always a question about whether you can trust non-Jews to do things for us halakhically, to make halakhic, establish halakhic facts for us. He says, you don't have to, because you can just go to a Jewish chemist and you can have them do it. And you don't have to worry about that. But you do have to worry that it's a small amount that halakhically it counts and it's important, but in terms of the chemical analysis, they won't catch it. You know that it's limited. So again, that comes up with, for us, is it still limited and how that works. So therefore, besides just you have to check if there's wine in there, because we said there might be wine in there, he says, so you have to do all these checking. People who are expert at this have to check into it, but if we eventually figure out that there's no wine in there and that we can be pretty sure that there's no chametz in there, then there's no itchazik yisur. We don't have to assume that it was prohibited, and therefore it should be okay. But he thinks you'd have to check each and every barrel in this way. You couldn't just check one or two or a few. You'd have to check each and every barrel. But if you did, then you would be able to say that they were kosher l'Pesach. And that is a tshuva of Rav Herzog's for the 6th of Shvat, about when and how you use chemical analysis to verify or to establish halachic fact. Have a great day.